Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own.
Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 168 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So you're like giving me this shaky, shaky head. What's going on?
That was a lot.
What were you reacting to?
I'm constantly amazed that, I don't know if you have it written down or not, but you're like 160, blah, blah, blah. The fact that you have that in check, I find amazing every week. That's it.
You mean the fact that I don't forget when I say it or the fact that I know the number?
All of the above.
Because I have a memory for dates and numbers. That's not, you should know that by now. But yeah, the hard thing was I was about to say 67 because the last one we did was 66. However, what happened was we got a little time bit behind. And then last week, even though we put one up, we had to quickly follow it by our interview with Tara Bennett, right? In the meantime, we have the lovely chat, which you will have heard, dear listener, by the time you listen to this. We hope you go in order. We have our lovely chat with friend of the show, Candida, for chapter 11, which at the time of the recording of this 12 and 13, we haven't shared yet. It'll go up this weekend. So this whole thing about like time travel and back in time and forward in time and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, that was a little bit confusing for me because I usually come up and just say the episode number. And after we save a recording, I put it in that folder. The problem is until it's done, you never know. So I just now call my files Voyager chapter 12 and 13 rather than episode 168 or 167 because it's not always in order because we will have the odd interview like we did last week. So 168, any announcements this week?
You know, there was a lot of stuff that went down this week. For instance, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, but Kate reached some sort of milestone with one of her charities and had like what felt like an hour and a half.
She hit 200,000 followers on Twitter.
Thank you. Okay. Well, she had what felt like, my whole point is there
a
was, it felt like
interview
for real. It was like a Twitter Q&A that seemed to go on forever. And I didn't realize I had notifications turned on for her, which I love, but I kept getting like nonstop notifications on my phone of things, not the questions coming to her, but her answers to said questions. And I was like, what is going on? And then I was like, oh, Twitter Q&A. And I swear it went on for like an hour and a half. So bless her. Bless Kate.
And there were a lot. There were two or three. Like there was one from her, one from Matt. Aren't there three or am I making that up?
Well, all I know is that Sam Heughan, Stephen Cree, and Sophie Skelton were all involved in Kate's.
I did see little dribbles of that.
Q&A. Like they were all responding to her. So it was a good Q&A. If you were not present, you should go back and look for it. I'm sure hashtag ask Kate still applies.
Yes. And as always, our friend Sarah with Outlander TV News got the most important or salient tweets from both Q&As from Matt and Kate, Katrina, and made a blog post for each. So you can find it all there too. OutlanderTVNews.com.
Okay, then. As that stands, let's move on to our read-along.
Okay, before I say anything,
yes.
Before Summer says anything, no, this is so funny. I wish we could get I guess I could. I could do a picture of a picture.
Of what?
Summer and I have a slightly, Summer and I, I'm talking to the audience now. Okay. Summer and I have a slightly new, as of like a week ago or last weekend, a slightly updated recording situation. So since we split the houses and the moving of the things and we each have our own, and I think we're very happy. We each have our own households now and we're building them back up and are you 100% moved in? I mean, your stuff is there, but you still have boxes, right?
A few. The boxes all live in the garage, but I mean, everything that's in my house is unpacked. The things that I think I need, I don't know what's in the boxes in my garage.
That's fair. Oh, by the way, I don't have my, I think it's a Belkin. I could be wrong. I don't have my water boiler. Big stainless steel water boiler.
Moderately unrelated to that. No, totally unrelated to that, but moderately related to you and I found the FedEx container in my garage.
Thank you so much. And we will not say what that is.
Wait, just the FedEx?
I haven't opened it. It's the long tube of FedEx.
Oh, it's probably both. I'm hoping that the big long...
I think they're all together. Say it slowly and sexy. Slowly and sexy.
I don't do that.
I'm hoping the big, long FedEx.
You know what's going to be taken out.
Probably.
Don't waste your time.
For me.
So that's good. That's good. And I'll say it, even though it's not related, but it's related. We said on Twitter and on Facebook, I think, and I know within our Facebook group, the Outlander Pod, like pod of, you know, pod of dolphins, ha, ha, ha. We said, and actually on Instagram too, we said a number of places that there will very possibly, and take the hint with this, very likely we will at some point, because you know we have giveaways all the time. It's random, but it happens. We will very likely have a giveaway at some point for which there's no way to enter. The only way to be eligible is to already be a member of our Facebook group. And so that would likely be some kind of random, you know, random number. And then we go through the list and count the number down. I don't know how we would do it at that point, but the only way to be eligible would be to be in our Facebook group. And that's the twist here. You say, oh, well, okay, great. You know, if I'll find out about it and I'll join. That's the point. That's the kind of the curveball. We are not going to be announcing it anywhere else. Now, we cannot help if someone in the group, you know, splatters it elsewhere and people join. Fair enough. But just so you know, it won't even be announced. See, that's the thing is, I know we're totally like doing this in front of everybody. I don't even know that we're going to announce it in the group other than to say, the thing is, if you announce it, then say we have 1,000 members.
True. But here's what's going to happen. The people currently in the group aren't going to tell people. They don't want to like ruin their chances. This prize is going to be pretty epic, guys. My point is people in the group already are not going to publicize it to other people that there is a prize within the group. So the only way to be on board with it is to join before the actual thing happens. And if we're not announcing it elsewhere, the only place to find out about it and the timeline attached to it is to join the group.
So if you're interested in maybe finding out about some likely giveaway one day, then, or even if not, we invite you to join us to continue the conversation. And the way you can join our Facebook community is the link. Summer, it's a very easy link. What is that link?
Outlanderpod.com/groups.
Singular.
www.outlanderpod.com/group. Oh, I'm bad at this. Okay. www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Yes. And we would love to have you there and we welcome everyone. It's a very kind of, I want to say low key. It's, but I will say there's no drama. So I like that.
I mean, it's early days. It could happen anytime.
It is early days. So yeah. So with that, Summer already announced it, but Summer, go ahead and announce the chapter name.
This week we are discussing not one, but two chapters. And by saying two chapters, chapter number two is legitimately like a page and a half. And so we are going to finish out part three of Voyager with chapter 12 entitled Sacrifice.
It's November at Ardsmuir. Remember, the last chapter left us in June 1755 when Lord John put the moves on the Jamester.
He's real bad at it, but yeah.
That's part of the... Oh, you know what? We totally started talking about how we have a new setup and then something else, and I never mentioned it. Since we... I'm such a nutball. So since we moved out of our home and got our own places and unpacked and all this stuff, you know, it took us a few weeks, but we got our whatever interim setup set up. And Summer has the TARDIS because she has room. And Ginger has a cupboard, but it's so cute. And painted
like
it purple.
Like a Harry Potter cupboard?
I mean, I'm not going to tell my secrets. It used to be your cupboard, so you know exactly what it is, that black one. I mean,
for real, my setup is, there's no secret. You just said TARDIS. Everyone knows what I'm working from.
I didn't say yours was a secret. I said mine was. Secret cupboard. Yes, exactly. You have the TARDIS because you have room, and I have a secret cupboard.
Is it under the stairs like Harry Potter?
I have no stairs, so no. Basically, we've been with our own computers. We still have our booms and our mics and our headphones, our earbuds, whatever it is. And we've been doing that through a new kind of setup, but without being able to see the other person, we've done okay. So the one change we have at this moment is not necessarily the recording setup, but last week when we interviewed Tara Bennett, Summer and I wanted, because we're in separate places, we weren't able to be in the same place, which for an interview, you really want to be, because you need to be synced on how the person, you know, so you don't interrupt each other. We use FaceTime to be able to see each other, and we just make sure it's muted because we have our earbuds in or our headphones on to be able to hear it through the mic. And as long as it's muted, there's no feedback. What you're getting is basically a webcam to the other person, but it's a internet cam. She just winked at me. She just waved at me.
I did.
So what it does is it allows us to see each other. And again, it's not as important when you have just the two of us and we're in different places. But when you have a third, whether it's an interview or just a guest, like a friend of the show, it's very helpful to be able to raise your hand, raise a flag, raise whatever.
It's super important. The whole thing is when you're interviewing a third person, especially when you're trying to be a unit as two against one, it's not against anything, but two people towards a common goal. If you can't see what the other person is doing and you can't notify the other one that you have something to say, then everyone's going to be talking over everybody. So I don't know why it took us this long to figure it out, but we figured it out, and it was actually...
Well, we've only been apart for, what, 2 months? So it's not like all that long, but it is kind of funny that we didn't think about it the first time we did it.
But we should have been apart longer. I'm just kidding.
The men were standing outside in the courtyard in the rain. They were doing a search and cleaning of the prisoners' cells. Diana writes, quote, "The trustees who did the actual cleaning closely watched by the guards," unquote. And I looked at it and it looked like a typo. And I said, is that a typo? Let's go check it out. So I have two different sources. And this is about the trustee, or trustee is a person, but it's also the name of a type of prison system. So a trustee prison system is one in which some prisoners were given more power than others. These trustees guarded the other prisoners. Prison officials did not have to pay civilians, non-prisoner guards, to control the prisoners. However, the trustees kept the other prisoners under control through physical abuse, torture, fear, and humiliation. Now, this was practiced in the U.S. as well until 1974, when a federal court ruled that the trustee system violated the United States Constitution by giving out cruel and unusual punishments. This ruling ordered the trustee system to be shut down. And that I will link to the Wikipedia article with its references there. And the other source discusses the system. And this is actually from the report of the Special Committee on Prison Labor in Ontario, Canada, from 1908. Quote, "While the trustee system has rendered our farming operations much more profitable from an economic sense and much more valuable for purposes of education and training, the moral gain alone justifies the system. The self-restraint necessary for these young men to resist the temptation to run away and the moral stimulus that comes by imposing upon them responsibility and assignment of duties results in the development of a degree of moral stamina that justifies an early parole and increases very appreciably the number of young men from this institution who become good citizens," unquote. Now, you could almost argue that I should have read those in reverse order. One is a reason for, one is an argument against a trustee system. And so basically, it's when certain prisoners are put in charge of certain things, including other prisoners. And it's not really a wonderful thing. So that said, what that means is that Ardsmuir, there was a trustee system in the prison. So some prisoners, it would appear, I couldn't find any references specific to England or specific to or Britain at all, let alone Scotland or England. But the fact that it was practiced here until 1974 and then practiced in Canada, or at least in Ontario. And there was a report in the early 20th century, 1908, leads me to believe that since early days we were both colonized by the Brits, that that is our common ancestor and our common source for a penal system. So that's my guess. And if anyone is a historian or knows about penal systems of the 18th century.
For real, I know nothing about what you're speaking of. However, the genealogy I've done, and speaking of penile things, a lot of your genealogy goes back to Ireland, Scotland, and the UK.
Mine?
Penile. Oh, yeah. You and me. Penile.
Why did you say your?
I'm just saying because it's, I mean, you mean in general. Yeah, in general. I'm just saying. And you follow on the paternal line, which is where I'm going with penile, you go back and you find, and you go from paternal to paternal to paternal, and they all go back to Ireland, Scotland, and England.
And what does it have to do with?
You said penile
colony.
You said penile.
Okay. No, I said penal.
Yeah, but I heard penile.
As in prison.
I heard penile.
This time, among the usual contraband, there was found a 6-inch strip of cloth with green tartan check. Lord John was like, oh no, oh no. Of course, Diana reminds us that the possession of any Scottish tartan was forbidden by the Disquilting Act. I imagine one day I might perform a disquilting act.
I'm just saying, it sounds like such a fun...
it's activity. Really well named.
The Disquilting Act. It's, but in reality, it's much more dire and sad. But it sounds like it should be a really fun endeavor.
Gray tried to think about Clan Tartans and the men in front of him to figure out whom it might belong to. Gray stops upon the name Mackenzie and notes one of the, I think, newer young men in the prison. And looks at him and says, or thinks, quote, his face was a shade too controlled, too expressionless, unquote. Gray goes to him, and his name is Angus Mackenzie. Gray confronts the young man, but before he can break him and before the man can admit to it, Jamie claims the piece of tartan as his own. Quote, the voice was calm, almost bored, and spoke with such flat indifference that neither Mackenzie nor Gray registered it at once, unquote. Now, Gray is right when he says that it isn't a Fraser tartan, but Jamie tells him that his mother's clan was Mackenzie. Now, what a wonderful line. Quote, in some far-off corner of his mind, Gray stored away another tiny scrap of information with the mall hoard of facts kept in the jeweled coffer labeled Jamie, unquote. Isn't that telling? In a jeweled coffer?
I mean, I have a jeweled coffer named Jamie. It's way more detailed than Gray's, apparently. It's got way more than his mother's maiden name. That's all I'm saying.
You could tell among the prisoners that they were reacting in their own way to Jamie's claiming of the tartan and thus young Mackenzie's punishment. Gray tells the guards to take Jamie away. Quote, with an effort of will, Gray forced his gaze away from the soft, smooth lips, slightly chapped from exposure to sun and wind, unquote. In his office, Lord John is signing requisitions. He's having a hard time concentrating because his mind goes back to the events of the day. And this is, of course, after Jamie has been flogged. And he's still cold. This cold that just gets in, seeps into everything. We learn that he'd given the order to have Jamie punished immediately. The prisoners were lined up around the four sides of the courtyard to observe. They made no sound. Now, this chapter is very Hemingway, very Scotland, with rain everywhere. Jamie strips to the waist, quote, as though this were something he had done before, an accustomed task of no importance in itself, unquote. They put his arms up to the top of the whipping post and gagged him. And this is, of course, so much. Now that we've seen season one, it is so much like what we saw him do, be done to him in season one when BJR whipped him. The sentence is 60 lashes. The men were all silent. They didn't even cough. Gray, however, was affected. quote, and over it all, like a sticky coat of varnish, sealing off Gray's feelings, was a thin layer of self-disgust as he realized that his eyes were fixed on the scene not out of duty, but from sheer inability to look away from the sheen of mingled rain and blood that gleamed on muscle, tightened in anguish to a curve of wrenching beauty, unquote. Okay, that is straight up BJR-like. He's not causing injury, but he, in his own way, finds it beautiful. This Jamie being whipped, or at least the mess, the beautiful mess that is Jamie. Though, of course, Gray is completely unlike BJR in almost every way. And after they reach 30 lashes, unlike BJR, Gray vomits.
BJR, like, keeps going and slips in it.
He gets excited, yeah. Lisa T writes, we have already seen Jamie flogged by BJR and the sadistic pleasure that he got from hurting Jamie. Now we see Lord John disturbed by it, but so desperately in love that he can't look away from Jamie's body. Martina P. writes, Jamie sacrifices himself for young Mackenzie and takes his punishment, like he did for Leary in the first book. Lord John was so filled with self-disgust that he wasn't able to look away during the flogging. While we are here in his POV, I wonder why he doesn't mention Jamie's badly scarred back at all. He notices every little detail on Jamie's body, but no mention of the deep scars. That would have been the first time to see Jamie without his shirt. Now, I actually thought about that too. Did you think about that some? Like, no one remarked at all about his back.
I mean, I thought about it, but I also thought, is he facing Lord John Grey? And if he is, then Lord John Grey won't see his back. So, I mean, I did think about it, but depending upon where he was standing, he might or might not have a really good view of what was going on back there.
Back there. We are in a dream of Jamie's. He's 19 and has just been flogged. He would have been in Scotland at this time and is being tended by an English surgeon. The surgeon doctored his back and then bolted the door and told him, quote, no one will come in now. Go ahead and cry, unquote. And then Jamie wakes up, and he's still in Ardsmuir. He was crying in his sleep. In the book, the other men call it Gritten. Seems he'd gotten a soldier who didn't really like flogging prisoners. So he was actually kind of lucky in whom he got. And Diana wrote, quote, still, 60 lashes did damage, even if applied without enthusiasm.
For sure.
Jamie notes that the men always find their own role. Morrison, who had been a cotter, was the doctory one. Jamie was the leader. He brought reassurance, direction, and justice. Now, the men are putting warm, wet cloths on his wounds. I think Morrison is. Jamie recalls that since he took the scrap of fabric, he had been detached. Like he saw it, but wasn't feeling it. Quote, these seemed all things that happened before. Nothing he said or did could change a thing. It was all faded. Morrison brings Jamie whiskey to drink. Morrison, Jamie notices, is talking a lot, and he's not normally a talker. He figures out what Morrison had been trying to keep him from hearing. Quote, the muffled sound of blows, slow and regular, and a heavy gasping of fright and pain, punctured with a small whimpering sound of indrawn breath. Unquote. They were, of course, beating young Angus Mackenzie. Jamie tried to get up, but Morrison forced him down. He tells him to be still. He couldn't do anything to help anyway. Recalling the first time he'd been flogged, he hadn't been gagged, and he had very nearly bitten through his lower lip. So he was actually happy that he had been gagged this time, or thankful anyway. He wonders how people know what they are supposed to do. Where do their gifts come from? And he echoes from earlier in Voyager, quote, Claire had known what to do, what she was meant to be. Not everyone was so fortunate as to know their gift, unquote. Now, Angus comes over to Jamie and apologizes. Jamie reassures him, quote, I am all right, too. Lay you down, wee Angus, and take your rest. Angus asks to stay by him, and Jamie doesn't say no. He thinks more of men and their roles. He'd been born to be a leader. But what of those who had not been born to the role they were required to fill? For example, John Grey and Charles Stuart. Jamie was finally able to forgive the prince. quote, having so often paid the price exacted by his own gift, he could at last see the more terrible doom of having been born a king without the gift of kingship, unquote. My gosh, does the beauty and sadness ever stop? It's like Jamie is like the man.
Well, my whole thing is that his stating him being, him finding some sort of a whatnot with his relationship with the Bonnie Prince Charlie in this moment, to me, meant a lot, because there was a lot of things that with season two, they didn't talk about, and they, you know, they let Jamie of season two be swept away with the idea of James Stewart, of Charles Stewart and his whatever to the throne. Like, there was a lot of things that they just kind of were like, well, he believes in it. And that was not from the book. And so for this moment in the book where he's just saying, this moment where all of this stuff happened, where I took a beating for this kid who couldn't think far enough ahead to get rid of this stupid piece of tartan, yeah, taking this beating, it allowed him to be like, I get it. There was a lot on your shoulders being the figurehead of this movement. And now that I am the figurehead of what's left of the Jacobites inside of this prison, quote unquote, movement, I kind of get it. So it was nice to be reminded that he was not as enamored of Charles Stewart in the books as he was on the show last season. Mm-hmm. So I appreciated that personally.
I totally get it. Diana describes Jamie's certainty that he'll be whole again soon. Quote, he could feel sleep coming for him, fitting back the shattered, scattered parts of himself as it came, and he knew he would wake whole, if very sore, in the morning, unquote.
More than sore?
How much of this gift is from experience? So he survived this and worse multiple times before. Or Claire, she helped him heal from the worst and helped put his soul back together.
I mean, that's a lot. He has such a wealth of experience and a wealth of knowledge from being beaten almost to death on several occasions, not just from whippings, but just in general. But also the fact that he was nursed back to health on multiple occasions by Claire. So I think that both of those things apply.
Eileen P. writes, after the flogging, Jamie describes himself as still in fragments. This echoes Claire's fragmentation while she's separated from him. We also see that Jamie is never quite whole. When living in the cave, he shifted between being cerebral and feral. Visiting Lallybroch, he starts to transform to being human again, but without Claire, he is never whole. In Ardsmuir, he is civilized in Lord John's quarters, but loses himself back in the cell. While recovering from the flogging, Jamie thinks he will be whole again in the morning. Yet the wholeness he is referring to seems more to do with having control of his thoughts and no longer being in a detached state. As with Claire, he cannot be whole without her. Together, he is part of something greater than himself. And this chapter ends so beautifully. In his knowing, in his certainty, he once again has his soul back, his mission, and his destiny. Quote, he felt relieved at once of many things, of the weight of immediate responsibility, of the necessity for decision. Temptation was gone, along with the possibility of it. More important, the burden of anger had lifted. Perhaps it was gone for good. So, he thought, through the gathering fog, John Gray had given him back his destiny. Almost, he could be grateful. Unquote. Lisa T. writes, just as Frank has helped Claire reclaim a part of herself, Jamie realizes that Lord John has helped him reclaim a part of himself as well. Even though they are separated, Jamie and Claire's lives and relationships parallel each other. Eileen P. writes, Jamie is shown as a Jesus figure, sacrificing himself for his flock's sins. Taking Angus Mackenzie's punishment reminds me of when Jamie took Leary's punishment at Castle Leigh. In both cases, he felt he was more able to handle the punishment. And it's interesting how Jamie detaches himself from the inevitable flogging. This even happens when he claims the tartan is his, perhaps because he knows the punishment. The detachment is like bracing for the strike. He is utilizing a defense mechanism. Unfortunately, the flogging triggers a flashback to his flogging at Fort William when he was 19. 100 lashes, another 100, and now 60 more lashes. His flashbacks remind us he is human and not indestructible. While his body can mend, his mind will always remember the assault on his body and the knowledge that the harm was intentional. Also, the description of the Ardsmuir flogging, followed by the flashback to Fort William, increases the magnitude of Jamie's sacrifice.
Can we talk about that for a minute? I don't know that he saved himself anything or he did anything good for the group as a whole by stepping forward. Because by him stepping forward, like if he hadn't stepped forward and if he'd let Tiny Mackenzie go and take his beating, his 60 lashes, then only one of them would have been injured. But by him stepping forward, Tiny Mackenzie didn't get his lashes that he earned by keeping that little tiny piece of tartan. And not only that, but Tiny Mackenzie just got his ass beaten by the rest of the dudes at Ardsmuir. So I don't know that he really helped anybody.
So you're saying rather than having one person beaten, that was going to happen anyway, two people were and one of them innocent.
Right. And the beating he got from his friends might have been worse than what he would have gotten as a lashing.
I don't think the beating was worse than the flogging.
I don't know. Were you there? Have you been lashed and or beaten?
He could walk over to Jamie's bench.
Well, I'm sure Jamie could have probably walked too, but he took a freaking nap.
Somewhere he was probably carried there.
Maybe. My whole point is that two people got hurt when only one person needed to. And I mean, it speaks to Jamie's character, and I'm not denigrating that in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying that I don't know that his quote-unquote sacrifice, as per the title of this chapter, was 100% necessary.
Well, that's the thing about sacrifice. It's not always necessary. And sometimes, looking from the outside, you think the person who did the transgression should pay for what they did. But that's what makes the sacrifice so wonderful and so awful, is that someone who didn't deserve it got some kind of punishment. And it's like a bittersweet.
Clearly, he was appreciative. He was like, can I sit next to you tonight? Can
I think he was mortified.
Mortified, appreciative, whatever. My whole point is clearly he got it. And he was like, I took my beating. I was an asshole. I shouldn't have had all this stuff with me. And I shouldn't have kept that tartan with me. But that being said, I'm super sorry you got flogged. I got my butt kicked by everyone else here. Is it cool if I sleep next to you? And I don't know if he wanted to sleep next to him because he wanted to be there, or if he was like, maybe if I sleep next to you, they won't beat me anymore tonight.
Well, that second point, that's an interesting consideration. I think they were done beating him because they stopped. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't want to lay into him again, of course. But I think that is a very fair question, if he thought it would protect him. But also, I think mostly he was super just shamed.
I'm sure.
And I think he thought, even though he could never, ever, ever make it up to him, ever, I think he thought that his apologizing and groveling in some capacity, like right after he was served his dues or whatever, that was never going to make it up to him, but definitely the timing was never wonderful. I think he felt that they had just shown him. He's like, yeah, I got to go. This dude, not only do I feel bad for it, I'm sure he didn't like getting beaten, but I'm sure part of himself thought, number one, he probably knew it was coming. And number two, was like, okay, well, thank God that's over with, or I got a little bit of something. He wasn't happy to be in pain, but I think he was happy to have been able to suffer a little bit, even though someone else suffered in his stead and very undeservedly.
Well,
but I like what you say. It's very possible.
The worst bit for me was that when the whole thing was going down, he almost seemed like he was prepared to stand his ground on it. And then Jamie stepped in and was like, no, it's mine. And he's just thinking, oh, F-U-C-K. Because he's just thinking, dang, I would be happy to take a beating from these strangers. And then everyone would be like, dude, bully for you. You took this beating. But the fact that he's not only now going to take a beating, but he's going to take it from his friends, that's even worse. I would rather get beaten by, like, the bad guy, the bully on the field.
But there's a difference. See, Jay, I mean, I know you know this already, but Jamie has been flogged. He knows what it's like. He knows it's not fun. But he knows that he, and he's older and bigger and tougher at this moment, and he knows that he will be able to handle it. He does not know that this young dude, malnourished, thin, whatever, full of spunk or piss and vinegar, as they say, he's mostly probably mostly talk and no game, or what do they say? I'll talk and no what? Bite?
I'll no talk, bite. No...
Deborah C. writes, unlike Frank, Lord John, and Charles Stewart, though, Jamie knows his destiny. This realization helps Jamie reclaim his destiny as leader and dispel the anger at Charles that had lingered. Eileen P. writes, quote, one man a healer, another a bully. And then, quote, one man with a weakness for drink, another with a hatred of it. One man a lover of women, and another, dot, dot, dot. Unquote. It's interesting how he ends that thought, Eileen writes. The continuation would be one man with a hatred of women, which could also be one man a lover of men. Perhaps Jamie's encounter with Lord John, or even Blackjack, accounts for him stopping his train of thought. It is also interesting that Jamie agrees with Frank regarding not everyone knows their gift, and that Claire is fortunate to know her gift. Jamie knows his gift and true nature is to be a leader. Yet it is also necessary to pursue that gift to form who you are. His philosophy helps him understand how awful it is for Charles Stewart to be born a king but deprived of the gift of kingship. Mark me. Charles was a horrible leader, but the uprising was a pursuit of his gift of kingship, and he was naturally compelled to pursue his gift. As Frank pointed out earlier, pursuing your passion comes with risks. Joe B. writes, Jamie reflects on destiny. He is a natural leader and knows it, yet John Gray isn't, and Charles Gray wasn't. Charles Stewart wasn't. The cost of following destiny, of knowing what one's destiny truly is understanding, not a reduction of pleasure. Excuse me, of pleasure. Not a reduction of pressure and stress. It's knowing that it's yours to bear. There's a reference to the quote from Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. Quote, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them, unquote, as we are taken through some of the players that have made Jamie who he is. Despite being the second born son, Jamie is a born leader. Gray has achieved some authority through his career, and Charles Stewart has had it thrust upon him by the weight of the history he felt he had to live up to. Knowing this, Jamie is able to forgive Charles and find again his destiny. Joby continues with, we are not told if the meetings between Jamie and Lord John have continued, but I can't imagine they would have been the same form if they continued at all. Any meeting would be business only, and any friendship is definitely over now, at least at this point. I have wondered, Joby continues, why Jamie thinks he had lost his destiny in agreeing to work with Lord John in exchange for removing his shackles, and then in his friendship with Lord John, does he feel he's gotten too close to the enemy? In feeling the relief of responsibility, even while his body is in such pain, he also feels the release of temptation. Of what? Is it to keep the anger and blame at both John and Charles as a reason for his situation? Is it in finding such commonality with John and then having that betrayed by his proposition? I don't know. Finally, Joby writes, taking the flogging for him is a great kindness to Angus, and from a man so abused as Jamie, an amazing gift to a young man. 60 lashes to a malnourished, weak boy in filthy conditions has a good chance of being fatal. Jamie knows he can stand this punishment he has before. It also creates a final break with Lord John. It's probably been very different since the night of the incident, but this is the end of a friendship by ordering the flogging. Which he would have had to do for anyone, but it's extra stress for Lord John. And of course, the power to resetting the boundaries has been given to Lord John. Jamie, I think, knows this, and like his relationship to Blackjack, it's a choice to yield his control to the other, and both Blackjack and Lord John were able to see that distinction. From the tenants of Lallybroch and prisoners to misguided princes and army officers, Jamie finds his destiny in helping others find theirs. Holy Moses, y'all.
Again. I don't particularly think he did little Angus any favors.
I think he did. And if nothing else than saved him the flogging. Yeah, he didn't save him the beating.
It was the flogging, but being punched and being flogged are two different things.
Flogging was much worse.
Is it? Have you been punched and flogged?
No, Summer, but other than, yes, a punch can, like, you know, damage internal organs and that kind of thing. So obviously there's always the chance of major internal injuries, of course, or like fractured skull. I mean, obviously there's danger in both, but as I said, Jamie had been beaten up and Jamie had been flogged.
And
Jamie knows better.
I'm not trying to take anything away from his sacrifice, i.e. the title of this chapter. I'm just saying he kind of deserved it and he should have taken it. And poor Jamie's body didn't need it. I get it that he is taking on this assumed role as quote unquote chieftain to the Ardsmuir prison regiment of whatever clan they're deciding to be.
The Ardsmuir clan.
Yeah, the Ardsmuir clan. I get it. However, that being said, he takes on more than he needs to, and he always does. And that's part of what we all love about Jamie. But this little pissant needed to have his ass handed to him, and he did by his own friends, but he should have had it handed to him by the British. And to finish out this week's episode, we're going to speak very briefly about chapter 13, which will end part three of Voyager. And this chapter is entitled Midgame.
It's Inverness, June 2nd, 1968. So we're back with the in crowd. Roger finds Claire on the sofa in the morning. Roger fancies Claire. Not over Brianna, but never forget he is drawn to her. Not romantically, but sexually. He is attracted to her. Quote, her skin was so fair that the blue veins showed through at the temple and the throat, and the sharp, clear bones were so close beneath that she might have been carved of ivory. Unquote. He studies that woman a lot. He takes the paper she was cradling from her. He sees the name on the paper. Quote, James Mackenzie Fraser, he murmured. He looked up from the paper to the sleeping woman on the sofa. The light had just touched the curve of her ear. She stirred briefly and turned her head. Then her face lapsed back into somnolence. Quote, I don't know who you were, mate, but you must have been something to deserve her. Unquote. And then he gently covers her back up, and he has the info, all the info that he needs on Ardsmuir. He can take it from there. And as Brianna comes downstairs, he whispers to her, got him. And another allusion to Jamie as the son via his daughter. Quote, she didn't speak, but an answering smile spread across her face, bright as the rising sun outside. Unquote. Deborah C. writes, Bree's answering smile when Roger told her that Jamie was in the prison rolls was, quote, bright as the rising sun outside, unquote. This reminded me of Claire and Jamie in the arbor at Fontainebleau. When Claire finally had the courage to touch and look at Jamie, she lifted her head, quote, and looked full into the face of the sun, unquote. Eileen P. writes, I really like that Roger likes and admires Claire. He also realizes that Jamie must be a wonderful man in order to deserve Claire's love. Claire has said that Roger has the ability to be honest. I think he possesses great thoughtfulness, empathy, and understanding. Joe B. writes, Roger finds Claire embracing the record of Jamie's imprisonment. His admiration for Claire now expands to Jamie. He must be worthy if Claire loved him, and his search has the next step, blessed by the sun of Brianna's smile. And finally, Lisa T. Lisa T. nails it, girl! Roger has a wee crush on Claire. I love the last image of Bree's smile being bright as the rising sun. Jamie is often referred to as the sun, but the image also reminds us that the dark period of separation for Jamie and Claire is almost over.
And that was the end of part three. Please join us next week when we begin discussing part four, entitled The Lake District, and chapter 14, entitled Geneva.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/Outlander Pod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Outlander Pod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Outlander Pod, or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.